Michael Bloomberg has been a man I've been fascinated with for many years. Working in the investment business for major Wall Street firms for the first 15 years of my career, I was witness to the changes to my industry brought on by the Bloomberg Terminal. Now, while I was considered a retail broker, meaning that I was working with individuals, I was constantly in touch with the bond desk, or the fixed income desks, as they're really called, which helped me choose bonds for my clients. I noticed early on how excited and more helpful these traders with their Bloomberg terminals by their side could be, and I took notice. Fast forward to last month when I became aware of a new book on Mr. Bloomberg, and we contacted the author and asked her to come on the program. You know, of course, all this was settled before Bloomberg's announcement to participate in the Alabama Democratic primary, so what I thought would be a segment about his most interesting career added a new volatile political element. So, now, I strictly avoid politics on this show. I leave that to others. But considering the latest announcement and the fact that he was mayor of New York for three terms, we will delve into that side of things. So, all that being said, I'm very happy to introduce the author of The Many Lives of Michael Bloomberg, Eleanor Randolph. Eleanor has covered national politics and the media for The Washington Post, The Los Angeles Times, and other newspapers. She was also a member of the New York Times editorial staff since 1998, focusing on politics, media, and Russia. Eleanor, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
So, when you were researching this book, what was your access to Michael Bloomberg, and how long had you been following him working as a journalist?
Well, you know, I was on the editorial board of the Times, and I was supposed to cover city politics. And so in 2001, this billionaire decided he wanted to run for mayor. And the editorial board of the Times, including myself, we supported his opponent, this guy named Mark Green, and just thought, you know, there's no way this guy is going to be mayor of New York City. And in fact, I think about that, he was 40 points down when he sort of got into the race. Mm-hmm. And I think about that now when we're all sort of saying, there's no way that Michael Bloomberg, who decided at the last minute last week that he was going to at least have the option to get in the Democratic primary, that he registered in Alabama and Arkansas, and he's going through the stations of the presidential nomination process. You know, and I thought about that, you know, it doesn't make sense to me that he could get the nomination, but who am I? I'm the one who said he couldn't, you know, he couldn't be elected mayor. Anyway, I covered him starting then in 2001 and had plenty of access, and then decided to write the book in 2013. And it took me a while, as you can tell. And, you know, so I had plenty of access to him, to his people, especially to his people in the early days on Wall Street and at the company.
Well, also, he would refer people to you, I think, the mayor of London at the time, who is now a famous person, Boris Johnson.
One Boris Johnson.
Yeah,
you know what Boris Johnson told me? He said, you know, I was just baiting him, so forgive me, but I said, I heard Bloomberg's not very funny. He said, what are you talking about? He said, he gave a speech here in Great Britain, and he was so funny that I was out-funnied by, I'm supposed to be the funny guy, and I was out-funnied by Michael Bloomberg. Anyway, Johnson said that Bloomberg was one of the great mayors in his era.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to get to that later on. Let's start with the earliest days. One story in your book that stuck with me was a story about how his parents had tried to move into an Irish neighborhood. And
that's right.
There were no Jews allowed. Why don't you tell the story?
Well, you know, I mean, it was, you should see this neighborhood. It is just sort of this perfect little suburban neighborhood. It looks like a TV sitcom, practically, you know, from the old 50s. And it still looks that way. Anyway, his mother, who was a very, very striking and powerful woman, decided that she wanted to move the family into this neighborhood. But they said there was a covenant that said no Jews were allowed. So what happened was that their Irish lawyer bought the house, and then the Bloombergs bought it from the Irish lawyer.
Yeah.
So that was a lesson that they talk about, you know, the Bloomberg family and certainly Michael Bloomberg, they talk about it as the example of what you do. If you can't go this way, you go that way. You know, if there's no plan A, you do plan B.
Yeah. So this idea of the plan B is a big characteristic of Bloomberg's style, right?
It's very much so. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So what kind of student was he?
Well, he was sort of, even starting way back then, he was a smart ass in high school. And he was not a very good student, but he was super smart. And he started working in this little shop, and the engineering sort of technician person there realized how smart he was and told him to apply to Johns Hopkins.
Mm-hmm.
So he went to Johns Hopkins. He ended up majoring in engineering, which turned out to be very important.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially when he was creating this Bloomberg machine that you like so much.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, he did really well in Johns Hopkins after his father died. He has always said that Johns Hopkins really made the big difference in his life. You know, he, instead of being a small-time accountant or something like that, that gave him the ambition or helped nurture the ambition to be something more than that. And he has always said that in these speeches, he says Johns Hopkins should erect three statues, one to Johns Hopkins, one to him, and one to the admissions director who
had either the stupidity or the foresight to to allow him to come in. So he went to Harvard after that. He got his MBA in Harvard.
Right.
And then he joined Salomon Brothers, right?
That's right. In 66, he joined Salomon Brothers. You know, he talks about going through the stations at Salomon Brothers. And he, at first, you know, he was in the bank vault counting documents that had to go to the bank, you know, at the end of the day, that sort of thing.
Well, the system back then was really, really terrible. They would count each piece of paper.
That's right.
And then they would take it across the street or down the street and have to deliver it at the end of every day. I mean, it's really hard to imagine a business being done in that fashion.
I know. You almost go back to the semaphores, you know, from the earlier time. But, you know, what was interesting about that, I mean, he was quickly promoted to the sharpening pencils upstairs in the, you know.
Okay, he got upstairs at least.
You know, he did very well at Salomon Brothers until he made an enemy. And then, as you know, they bounced him upstairs and made him in charge of computers.
At Salomon Brothers, I mean, the money, the prestige was all in trading. And
that's
for
right.
you to be moved out of that department and upstairs into the computer department was a huge kind of humiliating demotion.
It was. I always say it was like going from being the quarterback to the water boy,
instantly. Exactly.
And it was a humiliation. At that time, computers were considered, there were computers, you know, the beginnings of computers in that era, but it was considered women's work, you know.
Yeah. So then Salomon was sold. And he was not asked to join the new company. So in effect, he was fired from Salomon Brothers, which I would think would have been another devastating blow to kind of a normal person who might not bounce back from something like that. But as it turned out, his working in computers, plus the fact that they gave him a severance package of $10 million, which doesn't hurt. And he had made some friends there. He decided to try his hand at bringing computers to Wall Street. You want to take it from there a little?
Yeah. I mean, if you back up just one minute there, you know, those old guys that were pushing the carts with the paper along the streets of Wall Street every night, paper finally overwhelmed Wall Street. And so Bloomberg was there watching that and seeing these little sort of clunky little computers that were coming along. And he started telling John Goodfriend at Salomon Brothers, you know, we need to get more into computers. We need to use computers to help us with our trading. And, you know, they just thought he was a pain.
Well, he was kind of a pain, wasn't he? I mean, he was
I was trying to think of a nice way to say it.
Yeah, I mean, he was one of these guys that, you know, kind of probably just didn't shut up and wanted to be in control of everything. And, you know, it's hard to work with people like that. And not all of them turn out to be as successful as Bloomberg did, but it seems to be a characteristic to some degree.
Well, that's right. I mean, he was born to be in charge because he kept telling them, you know, how they should run things. So when they bounced him out, and the truth was he was enough devastated by that he mentions it all the time. Sometimes in a speech he'll mention it, and, you know, by then he's a billionaire worth $30 to $50 billion or something, and so it gets a good laugh. But the truth is, it was quite a dent. But he very quickly decided that what he had, he said he went home and made sure he didn't have any documents or anything from Salomon Brothers. Yeah. But what he had in his head was really important, and he hired three guys from Salomon Brothers who are now members of what they call the Three Comma Club, you know, billionaires.
Yeah.
And they knew about computers, and they knew what traders needed. And so they started creating this machine. And that story is a great Bloomberg story.
Well, I know also that he worked with Merrill Lynch at the time, because I was at Merrill Lynch during those years.
Oh, great.
Yeah. Well, I mean, again, I was in the retail. I was, you know, I was in the hinterland. Okay. I worked in Boca. We're not talking Wall Street, but, you know, you know what's going on. And I remember later on, Bloomberg going to Merrill and saying, listen, we've got this system and I want to expand it to other companies and Wall Street. I think this is something that the street should have, not just Merrill Lynch. And Merrill Lynch said, okay. And I often wondered until I read your book how he got them to do that. And the answer was that they had actually 30% of his company.
Right. They were making money as he made money. That's
exactly
right.
So they saw that.
Merrill Lynch got a lot of credit for actually, you know, starting him out. I mean, that first computer was, you know, it looked like, yeah, it was called MarketMaster, and they eventually changed the name because it sounded like a kitchen appliance. Yeah. But the truth is, it kind of looked like a kitchen appliance to us. Mm-hmm. If you look at it today, it's so amazing that those early computers could do what they wanted them to do. But Merrill gave him the chance, you know, to work it out, to work out the details, yeah, to kind of figure out how it would work. And then Merrill benefited when he expanded. You're right.
So later on, he bought back his share, or Merrill's share, during the crisis.
Yes, that's right.
When Merrill needed money desperately, but I think he paid them over $4 billion, some very high number like that.
Well, that's what we think.
Yeah.
They're very closed about that kind of thing,
sure,
over there at that private company, Bloomberg, yeah, LP, but that's what we think that they paid,
okay,
Merrill. So.
All right. Well, okay, so you qualified that number, but the bottom line was, as I read it, and you didn't say this, but I read it that he comes in at a time when Merrill is desperate for money.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the crisis, and then he makes his deal then.
Right.
And I think that's kind of an idea of the shrewdness of understanding what his business was worth and picking the time, the right time to buy his shares from Merrill Lynch. Right, let's move on a little bit. So, you know, we kind of got a good sense of his early years about the development of this machine. Now, this machine was revolutionary. It wasn't just a machine that allowed trades to be done. Now, I never had a Bloomberg terminal because I never really needed one. And they were expensive. They were over $20,000 a year.
They still are expensive.
Yeah, they're still expensive. So that's really for something for trading desks and so on, for kind of the institutional part of the business or real traders. And that was not me. But the bottom line was they had all kinds of information right at your fingertips that bond investors really needed, plus graphs that could compare two things very quickly and explanations of things, of definitions, and all of this stuff that made your life easier. So this was not just, you know, a kind of an administrative system to allow them to do better trades. This was a true intellectual property kind of innovation on Wall Street. And I think that's one of the reasons that it was so popular. His management style is what? I know he works very, very hard, but what kind of a boss is he actually?
Well, you know, I mean, if you talk about, he has people either love working there or they just, you know, can't take it because it is high energy. He talks about getting in at 7 a.m., but when he can't stand it, he'll get in at 6:30 a.m. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the kind of guy he is. And he chafes at an empty hour in his calendar. And he just works like that. He worked like that in the city of New York, which we now have a mayor who doesn't work as hard. And the difference is really noticeable here.
Yeah.
But the people who work for him in the city, most of the people I talked to who worked here in the city absolutely loved working for him. Now, he made a couple of mistakes in hiring, but what he said was the first thing you do if you're going to take over anything, like when he became mayor of New York, the first thing you do is you find the best people who can work for you. So Trump called him right after he was elected. And Bloomberg says that what he told him is that, you know, but hire the best people who can work for you. Hire people who are smarter than you are and take their advice. I'm not sure that the president has followed Bloomberg's advice to a T here, but that's kind of the place he started always. And, you know, I don't think you can overemphasize that. The people around him that he trusted and that he asked them, especially in the city, which is very interesting now, sort of as we look at whether or not he's going to try to be president. But in the city, he wanted them to be inventive.
Yeah.
And even if it caused him problems with the tabloid newspapers.
My guest is Eleanor Randolph. She's the author of The Many Lives of Michael Bloomberg, and that's what we're talking about today. So let's go to his time as mayor. So he controversially had a third term, but he had three terms as mayor. And, you know, managing New York City is near impossible, I would think.
Yeah.
8.5 million people. You actually had the opportunity to go through the New York City Municipal Archives and saw in detail.
I did.
How one person could manage that. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, look, you know, you're right. It's 8.5 million people. It's the city government itself is 50 departments and 300,000 employees. So you can see you really need to find the best possible commissioners to run things. And what I found interesting is how he used management systems to propose programs, to list where you were every single week. And what he would do often was announce the deadline when he announced the program, which, you know, puts pressure on the entire staff to get things done. And so he tried, as I said, a lot of different programs. Some of them just didn't work, you know, and politicians don't do that. You know, they don't try things that don't work, that might not work. And he often said that, like a scientist, if a scientist tries something, it doesn't work. That's great because you don't ever have to try that again.
Right.
You can try something different.
So all in all, his time as mayor was, I would say, very successful. However, he did have some blatant failures. Well, first of all, some controversial things like the fight against cigarettes, salt, sugar, you know, the nanny mayor, you know, title, which I remember when he was doing that, especially with the sugar, and I didn't know about the salt, but the sugar, you know, it's like, you know, I was like, you know, that's too far, you know, enough is enough with that. But that's kind of stuck with him, hasn't it?
It has. You know, I think of him as the public health mayor, and he started caring about public health earlier in the early 80s. One of the things he said was, you know, you can give money to Johns Hopkins for the School of Public Health, for example, but if you run a city of 8.5 million people and you cut back on smoking, you've made quite a difference in the lives of an awful lot of people. And they cut back on smoking. He often said that if you're a New Yorker, just before you die, you got 3 extra years because they cut back on this oil that polluted the air.
The trans fat oil.
Trans fats, yes. And they gave grades to restaurants, and that sort of cut back on salmonella poisoning and things like that. So there were a lot of lists of things like that that he cared about.
Yeah.
And, you know, the commissioners could come to him and they'd say what they wanted to do. And he'd say, will that save lives? And if they said yes, he'd say, okay, try it, you know, go see how it'll work. That's what happened with the Big Gulp 16-ounce Coke.
Yeah. Now, people could buy 2 8-ounces, but that wasn't really the point. Right. Right. Well, we are out of time, Eleanor. I want to spend another half hour with you. But let me at least drive people to the book. It's a very readable book, very interesting about this man. The book is The Many Lives of Michael Bloomberg. My guest has been Eleanor Randolph. And Eleanor, thank you for taking your time to discuss your wonderful book with me. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And folks, if you have any questions or comments, don't forget to go to stevepomerantz.com. We love to hear your questions and your comments as well. And also, you can hear this again on your podcast, too. Over 640,000 downloads have occurred. And just go to your podcast app, put in the Steve Pomerantz Show, or just say, Alexa, play the Steve Pomerantz Show. How cool is that? Eleanor, thank you so much once again.
Thank you.